From the Clark Ford Studio in Oxford, Mississippi, MBW Digital proudly presents the Oxford Exxon Podcast.
I'd say thanks for tuning in, but why am I going to give you a round of applause for something that you're supposed to do, to be frank?
And now, here are your hosts, Chase Palm.
And broadcast school has really paid off.
And Neil McCready.
I deserve to be on TV.
Edition of the Net Par Podcast. Chase Parm, Jeffrey Wright. We're going to visit today with our good buddy Jonathan Randolph. He is in his third season on the PGA Tour and an Ole Miss grad, a former highly decorated junior player as well. So Jonathan's going to talk to us about a little bit of child rearing, Jeffrey. He's got an 8-week old now. I'm going to take him on the road next week for the first time at the Byron Nelson. He's been getting some help and some tips from other PGA Tour players on how to navigate that. And then also the part of the schedule where needs some FedEx Cup points, needs to keep playing. So we'll discuss a little bit about how you balance rest with also needing to play every week. Because we talked a good bit off air and we're just in the third edition of this here show. But it is different depending on not just overall financial well-being, but where you are in this race, because that's one of the reasons the best players continue to be the best players, in my opinion, is they can pick and choose and make sure they take care of their bodies, where some guys, if you can get in a tournament, you've got to go play that tournament.
Yeah, and further, it's becoming harder and harder for guys like Jonathan Randolph, guys that have multiple times earned their tour card. And I think so many of us think, well, you earned your tour card, so like you get to go play all the events. It just doesn't work like that. And, you know, for a lot of reasons, but the main reason, you know, the guys that helped implement the policy, it was largely guys that were on the PGA Tour that were kind of establishing how they wanted the rules to go. And I hope everyone's sitting down for this. Those rules benefit those guys more so than the guys that are trying to rise up and make it. And so there's been really two big. I guess scenarios that develop that because of that. Number one, you see guys like Jonathan Randolph if they get a start, they can't say no to it, you know, and maybe you're not feeling great, but just you cannot say no to a start, because that could be the week that you play well. That could be a course that suits your eye. And, you know, lo and behold, that could be the week that solidifies your tour card. So you just can't say no to that. And then the other flip side of it is it's made a lot of these college guys turn professional probably sooner than maybe they would like to, because they realize, hey, I'm playing well. I have 8 or 9 sponsors exemptions that I can utilize, and maybe I can go earn my card that way. And so it's really, you know, I get why they do it. It was designed at the time, I think, to help like the Tim Clarks of the world, but it doesn't help the Jonathan Randolphs of the world. It just doesn't.
Yeah, you know, the one course that I think about with that every year is Jonathan always gets in and plays Torrey. And I go, there's no way that course fits his game.
No.
But it's at the beginning of the calendar year, and it's a start he can get, and it's a big purse. So, hey, let's go see what happens over the course of 4 days.
Yeah, and I mean, you talk about a course that probably – I'm not saying that Jonathan says, I hate Torrey Pines, but you got to think that when Jonathan stands on the first tee on Thursday, he's not thinking, you know, this is the place that I get that win. This is the place where I'm going to win my first tournament. And the sad thing is, like a lot of, you know, Colonials, a lot of these Harbor Town, you know, places that would be better fits for him, a lot of those have like invitational statuses. So it's a smaller field, and it just doesn't really benefit the guys that are, you know, that have earned their way, which I think is a feat in and of itself. But huge week for Jonathan starting next week, and it's really a huge part of the calendar for him. While maybe some of us golf fans might not think it's the most electric part of the calendar, I can't think of probably a pivotal point of the calendar for guys like Jonathan.
Yeah, it's a time of the year when I think he played 8 or 9 out of 10 weeks last year, the first time he was on the tour as well. And it gives him courses that set up pretty well for him. It gives him a chance to get some rhythm, to play a lot of weeks in a row, and to stay out on the road. And you're just trying to pile up points right now from right now through the Wyndham. You know, we mentioned the course thing, and kind of last thing on that, they move the Wells Fargo last year because of the PGA Championship. He had a T8 on that other course.
Yep.
He made the cut, and he played through Sunday, but was somewhere in the 60s this week when he got back. So that's, you know, just showing you same event, same time in the calendar, but different course, and it made all the difference in the world for him by about probably 100 FedEx Cup points.
And I don't know if you were leading me into this, but no shocker, the guy that won at Torrey Pines was also the guy that won at Quail Hollow last week too, Jason Day.
Have you found yourself being more okay with him?
No. In fact, I find myself even like, here's the deal. I respect his game. I just
can't, great player.
I just can't stand. Not only that, think about after he was at 14. When did he hit that duck hook with the 2-iron?
I believe that was 14.
So
yeah.
That's a shot that could have crippled a lot of people, especially considering that it wasn't like Wise and honestly Watney. It wasn't like either one of them were kind of backing down from the challenge, and he just manned up, and he goes and he gets two birdies on, you know, two of the toughest holes in the entire golf course to win the tournament. I absolutely, and I'm not the kind of guy that like doesn't have eyeballs and can't respect what he did there, but I still can't stand him.
We talk about this all the time. Just people get used to it. It's going to be what we do. If you're this PR guy, how do you get him more on that level of international players that are well-liked in America? What do you do?
Tell him to stop talking. Honestly.
It's not the talking for me. It's the body language. It's the needing 10 seconds to visualize the shot. It's every time he gets a hangnail threatening to withdraw from the tournament. It's the other things other than talking that bother me.
Right. My deal is, okay, I would tell him two things. Stop talking, because when I say stop talking, it's he always explains himself. And when he explains himself, that's when you realize, like, this guy is just a gigantic sissy, like just an absolute sissy. And so on top of that, then I would tell him, hey, can we maybe cut the pre-shot routine down from 90 seconds to, like, just 45? Could we cut it in half? And the problem is, if he believes that's the reason why he's won 12 times already, like that's an uphill battle. Like there's two big deals for me right now in golf, and I think this is an appropriate week to discuss it, because golf, this isn't a major, but it's definitely a tournament that is a recognizable course. You get a little more of the casual fan. Tiger's back in the tournament. You got Tiger, Phil in the same group. They've been electric this week. Cannot say enough good things. I like this version of Tiger and Phil the best, because they're really leaning into we're friends, but we're also still best frenemies. Like, I'm really enjoying this. So, like, you have all this attention, but pace of play, like, at this place, it's always a huge deal because there is so much trouble. Like, guys are a little more careful, a little more deliberate, if you will. And then on top of that, man, it's not a long course. And so I think we're going to really start to see. Did you happen to watch, Chase, that feature the Golf Channel did about the driver, the modern golfer, and the equipment, the body structure, and, you know, all of that? Did you happen to catch that?
I have not seen this, no.
Okay, so Cliff Notes version. Number one, Frank Nablo. It was a very well done piece. Like, he, you know, he interviewed everyone from like Rory, Dustin, Brooks Koepka, the guys that we think of like as the Justin Thomas, the guys that we think of as like the poster children for the modern golfer. And all of it is so predicated on driving. And because of the way that courses are set up now, where rough, let's get real, rough is not all that penal anymore. Like, they're on the record as admitting there's really no penalty for us anymore for missing fairways. Like, so we're better off hitting the ball as far as we can and wedge or 9-iron. Like, I'm going to be like, Brooks Koepka had the line, like, I'm going to be able to do whatever I want with a wedge out of the rough. I'm going to be able to stop a 9-iron before anyone else is going to be able to stop a 9-iron because of the way that I hit the golf ball. And it really is an interesting question to me, because I fall into this weird, I'm in this weird spot where I don't like, for instance, if I actually thought that guys were getting stronger and were swinging the club faster and they were the reason, like, their improvements were the reason why guys were hitting the ball farther, I would be okay with it, because like I'm always of the opinion that as time goes on, as more money is involved, usually it with competition and with more incentives, it usually breeds a better field. But man, you're having to start worrying about it, and I hate to say it, but I found myself agreeing with Chamblee, because Chamblee brought up two big points. They're not swinging it any faster than they used to, and the biggest difference that he's noticing is there's no penalty for missing the fairway, as has been mentioned by these guys. And so at a certain point, like, isn't the overall point of golf to control your golf ball? Like, I do think there should be a reward for a guy like Graham McDowell that's going to put the ball in the fairway 70% of the time, that's only going to hit it, you know, 290. Like, that guy should be rewarded for hitting the fairway 70% of the time. Like, at the end of the day, like, I do think that's what makes golf interesting. It's like baseball in that aspect, that not every player is the same. Like, you don't have to have the same skill set to be effective. And I just find myself wondering, like, what is the answer? Because I don't know if – as long as they're going to set up courses the way that they do, and we're even starting to see the U.S. Open go away from it. Like, think about – remember the – in our heads, when we hear U.S. Open rough, like, you and I just think about, you know, like, 6-inch gnarly Bermuda rough in which you can't find your golf ball. Like that's our thought. Like, we hear U.S. Open rough, like we think about that, and – man, that doesn't even exist anymore.
Here's the deal. It's got to be in a course setup standpoint. It's got to be what you're talking about there, where they get back to traditional courses, to longer rough, to being more penal off the tee. Because the thing about golf, between the amateur and the professional, is for the most part, they can play the same clubs. They can play the same ball. They can play the same courses. Where today, I could go out and get on a lot of the PGA Tour courses where events are played. I can go hit those same shots. And if you're not careful, you're going to have two things with the other options that we have in play. One is either courses that are strictly professional courses that amateurs can't even play the same game on because of where the boxes are, how they set them up, and whatever. They become nowhere near the same type of course, even the same possibilities. And then two, the rollback would be even worse. People talk about rolling back the ball. Well, amateurs aren't going to roll back the ball. So now you've got a professional ball and an amateur ball. It's going to take away marketing. It's going to take away money. Golf has got to find a way to fix it while still letting that 10 handicap believe, at least, that he's playing the same game as Justin Thomas or Dustin Johnson.
Yeah, I think the PR behind the ball, like the rolling back of the ball, is misguided. I don't think people understand. I think people just think, okay, well, like the way that they've marketed it, it's just like, hey, we're just going to have like a dead ball, like if you will, which that's not really the point. The point being was that if you played a classic style golf course, if you went and played Pine Valley, or if you played Cypress Point, which are, you know, two of the most famous and the most architectural like gems of the entire golf world, like the idea that you would need to have a ball to roll, like a classic course ball, because there's no more land that you can like rebuild those golf courses. And so like it's more of a preservation of the golf course than it is to try and limit these guys. And I don't think that message has been preached enough. And to me, I think that's what's fascinating, because recently, like I've told you, like I've gotten really obsessed with like golf course design and golf course architecture and the thought and the actual the process that goes into these people's minds that build these courses. And this is, I think, what makes it such a fascinating debate right now as we talk about modern golf. It's that, you know, I am totally okay if you want to take a huge risk and you're going to be the guy that you're going to hit it 330 and you don't care if it's a foul ball or not. I'm cool with that if you have to hit an amazing shot to recover. Like, that's kind of the point of golf. It's like, golf courses are largely designed that for these guys, if they play conservatively, they should be able to make par. And then occasionally they should have some opportunities to make birdie. And, like, they pick their spots when to get aggressive. And, like, to me, like, that's how the game was designed. But now, the way that they're setting up courses, there's no penalty. If you hit the foul ball, you don't have to hit the amazing recovery shot. You just got to grab your wedge and fire it up on the green and get it within 15 feet and then, you know, go right at the hole. So I think that's kind of where I struggle with it, because to me, like, if it were a situation where we're seeing guys that are 50 yards longer than even than they were, like, I think about, like, the 99 Ryder Cup. Tiger hit, like, an unbelievable drive. Like, it was the longest drive of the day on the singles match, and I think he hit it, like, 283. And, like, that was, like, there were guys, like, the TV broadcast was like, can you believe where he is, how far out he is? And it's like, wow, 283 right now, like, he wouldn't, like, he would, I don't even know, like, I don't even know if he'd be inside the top 20, 25 in driving distance, like, if he was hitting at 283. So, like, that's, I think, where I kind of struggle. It's like, I don't want to penalize these guys for being truly great if they're truly great, because what I keep seeing is it's not so much that they've made themselves better, it's that they're literally just taking these approaches to hitting their driver with reckless abandon, because there's no penalty if they don't hit the fairway.
We're getting there slowly. Is as much as we've criticized it, we're at least better than the, hey, let's Tiger-proof the course where we just make it longer, which makes Tiger that much better. I mean, that's the irony of doing that crap, is that the longest hitters, well, they've got even more advantage. Yeah, maybe they've got to hit 6-iron, but now somebody like Brian Harmon's hitting a hybrid into that same green. So we're figuring it out after being really dumb over the course of 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, I think it's heading in the right direction, because I used to get really miffed that, like, if you take, like, golf course design, like, for basically most of our lives, every person that built a golf course wanted it to look like Augusta, because Augusta had this pristine reputation, and so we started having, you know, like, honestly, we had courses in Southern California, a legitimate desert. Like, Southern California is a desert. And we had these courses with, like, these huge, like, tall pine trees, green grass and whatnot. So it's like, dude, that's not Southern California. Like, Southern California, for all its flaws, it does have some pretty cool topography. Like, it has a cool setting if you just lean into it. Like, if you just embrace it. Instead, like, everyone's trying to make their golf course into Augusta, and no one would ever factor in Augusta legitimately has a limited budget, an unlimited budget. And then on top of that, it's only open about 7-8 months a year. Like, so they're able to kind of manipulate their golf course to make it look like Disney World for golfers. Like, but it's not meant to be played every single day. And so we're now starting to see this movement towards, like, when people are redesigning golf courses, like Pinehurst number 2, it was a restoration. The idea was to make the golf course a modern, like, you were trying to hit the same shots that Donald Ross designed in the, like, 1919, and you, like, you were trying to restore that and the look of that, and it was meant to, the ground game was meant to be an element, and you're starting to see these golf courses that, hey, man, there might be some brown spots here and there, but that's because it's Bermuda, and Bermuda, like, that's the way the grass looks. And so I do think that we're starting to see that that's becoming more and more of a trend. And so I do agree with you. I'm hopeful, like, we can kind of figure out this idea, because I am worried right now it's just going to get, like, stupid, because it's really trending that way. Because until there's, like, a deterrent for these guys to play a different way, why would they play that way? I wouldn't if I could do it.
No, it's absolutely going to have to come from the tours and from the top up, not the players. From that direction, because no, I mean, absolutely, you're going to use what you have to talk about what you mentioned a second ago with driving distance. Zach Johnson, we know, think of him as long by any standpoint. On his driver, 291 yard average, which is 141st on the tour this year.
I mean, there you go. And by the way, if a guy averaging 291
is short.
Like, it's unbelievable, and I believe those count, like, three woods and everything. Like, I think when that's, like,
well, no, that is his driver only. Okay, he's 281 on all drives.
So they're even better. Like that's unreal.
Yeah, like, driver only 291, all drives 281. The 281 is 146th, on the PGA Tour this season. So that'll kind of dovetail into the players a little bit, because everybody kind of has a chance at this event. And we'll talk about that, get a little picks. But first, let's go to Jonathan Randolph now as he gives us an update on his season and family life.
Jonathan, welcome in home for a couple days before you hit the road once more. We'll start here. I was talking to Kevin Weeks last week. Sounds kind of weird to say. We were discussing getting kids involved. I was talking about my two-year-old, you know, at some point in the future, obviously, years. What's sort of your story for getting and going to golf? How'd you get the interest? And then what do you kind of remember of it as a kid and how it all began?
Yeah, so I'm told my first word was ball. So I guess I was drawn to sticks and balls and wanted to hit stuff. But, you know, I grew up, my dad played a little bit, but not a lot. And he cut me down an old 8-iron, and I just started dragging it around and hitting balls whenever I could. And then it led to me going to the course with him and hitting until, you know, he was done hitting or trying, and then picking it up and going to the next one. And just, I don't know, I just always loved the challenge of it.
Were you a big junior golf guy? I mean, what'd you do, you know, as a young kid? What was kind of your path to obviously eventually Ole Miss? But I mean, way before that, how did it kind of get going from a competitive level?
Yeah, so I grew up playing you know, a bunch of different sports, all the rec sports and soccer and baseball and all that stuff. And I was really drawn to baseball and golf. And I was on some really, really bad baseball rec teams. And I was getting a little bit better at golf, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a standout by any means. And I played in a baseball tournament, and I struck out a bunch. Like, I was a line drive guy. I was not exactly a power hitter. But I just couldn't, like, attack the ball right. And then I went to the state junior the next week, and I couldn't hit anything but snap hooks. And so I was like, well, I'm equally frustrated with every sport right now, and I'm not very good at either one of them. Like, you know, I'm respectable, but I'm very realistic with, you know, what the future could hold. And I just decided at that point that, you know, golf was the way that I wanted to go. And I quit baseball when I was 14 and started playing full time and really focusing on it. So it didn't exactly start like Tiger Woods on the Johnny Carson show. I don't know what he was on, but wasn't quite the same path. But
so how long does it take, and when do you realize, hey, I'm a high school golfer or a junior golfer, and hey, I can get some of college paid for, I can do some college golf here, and this might be something?
Yeah, well, I always knew that I had a chance. I was really, you know, I always tried to be competitive, but I you know, realistically, it was going to be a D2 school or a junior college to start out with. And then I started working a little bit more with some instructors that got me moving in the right direction. When I started working with VJ and Tim over at Waverly, I almost won the BFI over in Greenville. It was a big deal, lost in a playoff. And then I won the Bubba Conley, which was a really big deal. And that got me into some big tournaments, started playing with the likes of Ricky Fowler and those guys, and got a lot more attention. And I made the cuts in those tournaments, which gave, you know, the college coaches gave me the time of day at that point, and that's kind of how I got my foot in the door.
Who beat you in the playoff? You remember?
Bobby Hudson, absolutely. Okay. He's just stopped caddying for Cody Gribble. He's playing some mini tour stuff again, but he's a good player. But he was from Memphis, and I made bogey on the first hole, and he made par. And when we shook hands, he said, "Thanks, man. You just bought me a new car stereo. My parents told me if I won, they'd get me some subs put in and stuff." And I was like, "Great, man. My life's over."
Congratulations. I really enjoy that.
Lost the tournament. Everything, you know, everything's caving in on me. Congrats on the subs.
But it was the start for you. I mean, you mentioned that. You get to Ole Miss, play well, and you really don't have any idea at that point. I mean, do you know what kind of where your game is relative to what it needs to be for the next level? I mean, how much of an unknown is it when you're coming out of college and trying to figure out what's next?
Very, very different. Just every level of competition was so much different, from playing the Gulf States PGA at Columbus Country Club to, you know, even the state junior to, you know, I was fortunate enough, my dad, you know, he had the ability for me to go play in some of these bigger tournaments, like to pay for me to play. And I played in a Hooters event when I was in high school, and that was a Dancing Rabbit, and I made the cut. And so it was that point, right before my freshman year, I knew I had a chance. And, you know, a lot of guys don't get to, you know, I think it was like an $1,100 entry fee, which is absurd. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just like the cost of amateur golf sometimes is a little bit wild. But It was when I made the cut and I saw I was playing against Casey Wittenberg and some of those guys that were really, really good, and I was able to come close to hanging with them coming out of Jackson Prep. I was like, all right, I got a chance. And then you know, had Jonathan Dismuke was my assistant, the assistant coach, and he, Ernest had a lot to do with me, but Diz was on the course with me a lot and taught me how to shoot low numbers, and I think I set a freshman record for rounds under par or something, and that's when I really knew I had a chance, was that year stretch.
Is there an answer to making junior amateur golf more accessible? I mean, what's next to kind of keep more kids involved?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. There's more courses now that are more open to juniors. When I was coming up, 2005, I remember getting, 2004, 2005, I was like sophomore, freshman. They used to not look too kindly upon you, and I mean, for good reason. They had paying members that wanted to play and stuff, and it's hard for juniors to pay as much, but the good thing about, there's certain big tournaments now that if you want to try to qualify and play in, you can play in. And I remember trying to qualify for the State Am at the Refuge and doing stuff like that. And, that's kind of where you need to get started. If you're an amateur golfer and you really think you can try, you'd be surprised at how competitive it is and how much it'll get your juices flowing and how much fun it can be just to try a qualifier. And that's how it got started for me.
You're headed to Texas here in a day or two. Byron Nelson next week. It's at Trinity Forest in Dallas this year with a new course. How do you go about preparing for a course that most people haven't seen and really hasn't even been operational for that long?
Yeah, so last year in Wilmington, we played a course nobody had seen for the Wells Fargo, and I finished eighth. And I played pretty good, but it wasn't, my best. So I love it when we go to new courses. I was leading the Nelson. I was leading it on Saturday, playing with Jordan Spieth and the final group on a week that there was fish in the bunkers in the morning because there was so much water that the river was like flowing into the golf
course. Hold on, you're being serious, literally.
Oh, 100%. Like we played a par four as a par three on one hole, and it was a wild week. But I mean, I embraced it. I love the adversity. I love all that. When some of those soft guys have to play tough, but. It's going to be, I'm going to get there and just get my practice rounds in. I'm going to play a pro-am on Monday and then play again Tuesday. And I mean, everybody's got to play a new course. And I love links golf. I love, when you have to see shots. Last week I needed a couple of birdies on the back, on the front nine. It was my back to make the cut. And I clipped a tree off the tee and I had about a 10-foot gap from like 225. And it was like, well, I got to hit it through that one gap or it's going to hit a tree and then hit those kids over there, and I hit it to like a foot. So it's like, I love having to see shots. I love having to, not just have a cookie cutter straightaway hole. So I'm looking forward to it.
You're from Mississippi. Where have you gotten a lot of looks at links over the years? Where'd you kind of get your first introduction?
Well, yeah, I played a lot of Robert Trent Jones courses, which are, there's some of those that are a little linksy. But I got to go play I was fortunate enough to play the Palmer Cup over in Northern Ireland at Royal Portrush. And I played the British Am at Muirfield. And before that, though, I played after that, I played Bandon Dunes for the U.S. Publinks and finished second in the stroke play and then lost in the semis. So that's very linksy. And, for some people, they get super frustrated seeing a ball beat next to the hole and then roll 40 feet. But, for me, it's just another thing you got to go.
And in some ways, it sort of takes the numbers out of it. In America, we're so obsessed with par and what courses are to par. Over there, it's just, hey, get it in the hole in fewer strokes than that guy, no matter what this number may be. Because, I mean, depending on the weather, that could be anything.
Yeah, for sure. And, they've got double greens at Trinity, on a couple of holes. And they got a couple of par threes. Colton Nose played it the other day. I was talking to him, and he said into the wind, there's some really big holes. And there's some holes that you cannot fly the ball on the green. You got to land it off the green and watch it roll and do its thing, but it's it's gonna be fun and different, and that's kind of the nice thing is different. It's always fun to get a new look.
What is your preference on week of the event, when you show up, how many holes you play? How do you kind of prepare from that Monday through to the first round on Thursday?
Yeah, if it's a new course like this, I try to do 18 on Monday or the Pro-Am on Monday because sometimes it's in a card if you look out. But then if you've been to the place before, like earlier this year for the Zurich, my partner only played 9 holes before it because he's played TBC Louisiana enough, and I played 18 on Tuesday, but that was it. So, a lot of guys have been talking about how they've been, the trend has been for people to play more. And I did that last summer. I played 10 in a row. It was too much. I was kind of a zombie at the end. But a lot of guys are doing 9 holes Tuesday. And then, not my style, they wake up at like 4 in the morning and play in front of the Pro-Am on Wednesday and play 9. So you got to tee off by like 6:30 usually. First tee time's usually around 6:50. So, it's it's whatever you want it to be, but you know, different people do different things, and sleep is really important to me. So,
is there a difference or an advantage to your practice rounds being morning versus afternoon? Do you like to see some of both? I mean, is there enough course change to make that relevant?
Sometimes there is. One thing I explained to Brayden before the tournament last year in Memphis was how different Monday and Tuesday are, even from when you show up on Thursday, and especially by Saturday. They usually quit watering. You know, like last week they were doing hand watering in a certain amount of places, and for the most part it plays so much different. You just need to have the outlook of knowing how different it's going to be going into it, and know that, you know, you could show up and the greens be a lot faster. You know, a ball lands at the same spot and rolls another 15 yards and goes in the rough instead of, you know, ending up where it's supposed to. So, you know, it's more or less, it helps to have played the tournaments before and just to have your eyes open to the fact that it's going to be different.
You mentioned rest. I mean, in your situation, we're obviously looking for a certain number of points and dollars for continue membership. What's the balance there of, hey, if I can get in the tournament, need to play it versus rest as you go?
Yeah, so this is my third year on the PGA Tour, and I voluntarily skipped my first event ever this year already. I didn't go to Punta Cana because it was a good reason that our son was born the week before. But you know, I was talking with my caddy about it. Even if, you know, there's a stretch coming up where I could get in 10 in a row again easily if you get in the U.S. Open. So I will skip an event voluntarily again. I will not do it to myself. It's just so hard. Even if you're playing good, you know, finishing 70th in an event, you know, it's really nice. You get a pat on the back, good job, but like, it really doesn't help. You need to play better than that. And I had a couple of tournaments where I easily made the cut. Like I was, you know, sitting in 20th, 30th place and then just absolutely spun my wheels. And it was because I was, you know, it seems like such an easy, like it's a hobby for a lot of people, but it's just the grind of it week in and week out. You know, when you're playing greens where every pin's where they want to make you look stupid, or they want to goad you into hitting it at it when you shouldn't because you hit it here and you're gonna make bogey in that bunker. You know, it's just stuff like that. It just like chips away at you. So need some rest.
How is it mental versus physical? I mean, obviously you're walking the course 6 days in a week and so trying to play, but then at the same time, like you mentioned, I mean, depending on the course or the situation, it's kind of like a pitcher because they've got high-stress innings versus regular pitches.
Yeah.
Not the same thing. So, I mean, a certain number of high-stress pitches, high-stress round shots, that's going to take more of a toll on you than some other things, I would assume.
Not even a question. Yeah, my caddy and I were talking about this last week, too, when we were talking about the rest. And we've been the Brewers have had early in the season, they had a lot of one-inning games. They were in a lot of tight ones. And really, I've had a lot of tournaments lately where I've been on the cut line on Friday, and like it's just been high stress. And you know, you got to find ways to decompress. And really, when you're in those high stress situations, you know if you're close to having, you know, a good day the next day and breaking through and jumping up into the top 20. And it's really annoying when you know you're just playing as good as you can to make the cut, and that you know anything could happen. But you know, last week, for instance, like I was playing, I was getting better as the week went on, had a tough start to the day Thursday, and then Friday I shoot 2 under and jump up like 60 spots or something like that, and I was at 1 over for the tournament. And if I just would have shot the same thing the next 2 days, I would have been close to a top 10. And so I knew going into it, I needed to rest up. I was like, here we go, like let's make it happen. And then I showed up on Saturday and it just wasn't there. And those are that's when you get super annoyed, and when you have to, I mean, those are high leverage situations. There's two groups behind Tiger, there's a million people. And, you know, it's one of those things where you gotta take it and just get the best you can out of it and be ready to go when it's time to go.
Mentally, what is the key to getting through a round in the best way possible when you're not feeling it the way you could?
Just don't do anything stupid, because then it just starts feeling like it piles on. There has to be a shot. I mean, as cliched as it is, like there has to be a shot that's kind of the momentum swinger. For me, it was that shot on the 11th hole. I was playing with Drew Love, Davis Love's kid, mm-hmm. And so Davis is out there, and he had withdrawn or something, but he was out there watching Drew, and I hit it in the trees, like had that little gap, and I was like, man, like I could care less actually what anybody thinks, but like I don't want to hit this tree and have the ball come close to Davis Love, even though like he's a colleague technically. But and so when I executed that and it ended up like 3 feet, it still broke. Like I had to play it 6 inches outside the hole. It was a crazy putt, and I made it, and it was like, all right, we're making the cut. It's over. Like it's not gonna happen. So there needs to be something. The year I was leading the Nelson, like I remember I couldn't get anything going. I was playing with Jordan. I'd made a couple of par putts, and then I hit this 3-wood and just roasted it up the hill to like 6 feet for eagle, and I made it. And last week, I was on Saturday. I started bad, needed something good to happen, roast a 3-wood, skits, goes like 290 down this hill, curls up to about 10 feet, and I just absolutely whiff on the putt, just miss it. And I looked over, and I was like, we got our work cut out for us. Like, this is just the kind of thing that happens when, you know, it's going to be a tough week.
You mentioned being a couple groups behind Tiger. Is there a, I mean, and again, just a golfer in a way, but is there a tangible energy difference just if he's even in the field on the grounds that day?
100%, yeah. You know, he doesn't move the needle except all the way past the full. Like everybody shows up at like, cause so I was in, I want to say I was in like 60th place or something like that. Or maybe I was I was an hour and a half into tee time. So that's pretty early on a Saturday. And I mean, it took me forever to get in the golf course cause there were so many people already walking in, and I get out to the range and it's just packed. Like kids are like asking for autographs and stuff. And you know, I just had breakfast. Like, I'm, you know, it's not, that's not the norm. And yeah, I mean, it's cool. I mean, he's sitting there hitting balls. I was hitting balls, like, right next to him, and everybody's sitting there watching. You kind of hit a thin one and start thinking, like, oh, man.
Let's not shank one in a Tiger right here.
Yeah, no, it's fun, though. It's fun. It's, you know, I grew up with a poster of him on my wall, and it's fun. It's cool. It's just one of those things where that's what you wanted to do your whole life, and if you're there and you're getting to play with him, then you did what you were, you know, trying to do. So now execute. Don't look like an idiot.
When's the last time you shanked one in competition?
It's been a long time. It's been a really long time. I really can't remember it. I remember I saw one very recently.
Did you really?
I saw a couple of them.
Okay.
I've had more than one, but yeah, somebody gave it the Hosel on 17 down the hill. I don't know who, one of the first guys off hit it over there. Pretty hard to do, but it ended up on dry land, so that was good.
You have to want to just put your head under the next tee box at that point and get out of there.
The team competition the other day, we were doing alternate shot, and the last hole of the tournament, really tight. Like, Louisiana, bless them, I've never seen it. Like, it's sand-based because they're used to getting so much water, and former champ Brian Stewart just lays sod on one right into the bunker right in front of me. I mean, it was like a 50-yard shot. It went 40 feet. And so I literally, like, I put my head down and looked, and I said, all right, just give me a happy thought, Dave, anything. I was talking to my caddy, and he was like, just a nice crisp one, one hop it to the flag. And I was like, all right, good. And I just, like, I had to block it out. And I hit it to, like, thank goodness, like, 6 inches, because the thaw was in my head, 100%. So you just kind of, you got to put your head down, forget about it.
So far this season, I guess even dating back to the fall, if you want to, what's the one shot you'd like to have over again?
Oh. The one shot, you know, I can honestly say I don't regret much that, you know, right now in the recency bias, like I want that eagle putt back really bad because I hadn't missed a putt low all week and then I jammed it through the break, like completely jammed it through the break. But at the Sanderson, I pulled out 3-wood with an iffy lie and hooked one in the hazard when I was like 2 back, I think, on like hole 14 on Sunday. And hindsight, I probably shouldn't have done 3-wood. I probably should have hit like 4-iron and wedged it up there, but I really wanted to make eagle. So
part of me too would just like to have the 3-wood over again, right? Just get the shot over instead of the.
I can do it this time, but no, it's you can't. That's one thing I'm happy with is I don't have a lot of regrets. Sometimes I wish I would have practiced more on certain things. Like I had like a 50-yard bunker shot the other day, and I just played to the front of the green. I didn't even go with the pin because there was water right behind the green. It was on that silly drivable hole. And I was like, yeah, probably could have practiced this week a few more times so I didn't feel like I would thin it or, you know, plug it in the bunker. But
you mentioned the little one now. Has that changed practice schedules? How has that kind of altered things for you from a making sure you get work done standpoint, but then obviously not missing moments?
Yeah, so he'll be 8 weeks old on Thursday. And really, my wife's incredible. Like, hasn't, you know, there's not a whole lot I can do right now from what I understand.
No, you're just kind of there for support and encouragement at the moment.
So it really has been, there's just been a lot more of me taking care of household duties that I'm supposed to. But, you know, I'm still able to get out and practice a lot. And they haven't been on the road with me except for the one weekend in New Orleans. So Yeah, we'll just, it'll be a whole new adventure. There's a lot of veteran guys out there that have been giving me advice on what to do when the time comes and they get on the road. So I'm in good hands, but I just got to take care of business even more, I guess.
What's the best piece of advice you think is going to be coming up that they're giving you?
Get 2 bedrooms just in case. So get a hotel that at least has a living room with a door that you can shut, and you can go sleep in that room, because it always happens. Like, you're going to be playing really, really good, and you're going to have like a 2 o'clock tee time, and all you need is like 6 hours of sleep, and you just, like, it'll be hard to find. So
yeah, you're one of like the 200 people or so on the planet whose wives would allow you to sleep in another room to play golf the next day. I mean, you're
yeah, she told me to book another room for New Orleans, and I didn't. I was like, no, we're going to do it. And he slept good. He was a champ. So we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. But for the first big full week, you know, pre-cut and everything, he'll have another room if he needs it.
It's like you told me, you take gloves to baseball games so you don't hurt your fingers.
That's right. You got to protect the merchandise. Can't play golf without fingers.
And you've gotten a ball recently.
Oh, right? Yeah. I was a clean grab. I'm fielding 100% this year. So came up, just a quick reflex and got it. But yeah, it's fun. I went to a game the other day without my glove, and it felt weird. They gave us seats to the Charlotte Knights game, and I didn't take my glove because I was like, oh, it's a box. Like, who need? And it was prime foul ball territory. I was on my toes the whole game. So,
would you have gotten made fun of with the glove, or would there have been other gloves?
Oh, no, they would have respected it. You know, just at least not to my face. They wouldn't have made fun of me. So.
So what's do you know yet, kind of upcoming schedule next month? So what's going on?
Yeah, so it'll be Dallas next week, and then the week after will be Fort Worth, and I'm fringe to get in that tournament, and I kind of wouldn't mind not getting in that tournament because U.S. Open qualifying is the end of the next week, and then, you know, Memphis and all that stuff. So it's going to be really hectic. It'll be nice to be home for a couple of weeks or week and a half or so, and then yeah, Memphis, and then U.S. Open Travelers. It just goes. It just starts really fast. You know, you go all up in the Northeast, and then John Deere, British, Canada, Reno, and then it just all comes to a stop and starts over again.
That's all over the country. That's
yeah. It's not for the weak at heart. It's everywhere.
Where is Open qualifying?
So the Open qualifying is in Memphis again. They changed the courses just to keep it interesting, I guess. Instead of being Germantown in Ridgeway, it's Colonial in Ridgeway. So we'll be doing hopefully I'll get a few practice rounds in there and do the longest day in golf again, 36 holes. And last year we did 37 with a rain delay, and then had to come back again and do more the next day. So, and then play a practice round for Memphis. I don't know how. It was the start of a very long 10-week stretch.
What was that night like where you're waiting to try to qualify and finish that next morning?
I was just so tired I fell asleep, honestly. Really? Like, I knew that – so it started out as a 5 for 2 mm-hmm. or 6 for 2, and Scott Brown hit one pretty bad. I knew he was out. And then a kid that's a freshman at Bama hit one not very good, and so it was down – and I had already hit one in the fairway, thank goodness. And it was just absolutely
You're trying
raining.
To watch carnage at that point.
It was raining so hard. And I'd already made like a 30-something footer to get in the playoffs. So I was – and you're just kind of numb. I mean, like, you've earned it to get there, so you might as well do it. And, by the time I went to sleep, it was 3 for 2, and I knew Memphis would be a pretty high first alternate, and I would go up there anyway. It was Wisconsin. I'd go watch a Brewers game and do whatever. And then, you know, clutched up, got through. I mean, pretty good. Xander Schauffele, winner of the Tour Championship, had to beat him, and a kid named Wee Kim, who also finished like top 5 in Memphis and has had a really good career. So it was it's fun. It's fun to look back on, but that was a long day.
You're pretty familiar with Southwind and the St. Jude. How do you think this is going to fare as a WGC moving forward for next year?
It's going to be hot. I know that. I know everybody loves the course. It's challenging. Memphis and the surrounding area can handle it and everything, but it's going to be hot. You know, it's just like when I was a sign boy at Annandale in July. It was really hot. So,
but I can say this. I don't know if you can or will. It's almost kind of fun to watch them complain, though, wouldn't it be in August Absolutely. When they all come in? And
yeah, I'll be the only guy with the, like, cool rag that actually has, like, I won't be wearing, like, a cotton shirt with, like, skin-tight pants on. Like, I'll be the only one comfortable out there probably with my sweat rag.
Do you see, I mean, you know, some of the hot events and stuff, whether it be a European or somebody come in and go, hey, yeah, you're not dressed right. This is going to be a long day for you?
Yeah. I remember I saw Kevin Na, I think it was. It was Kevin Na at Annandale wearing black shoes, black pants, black hat, black shirt. And he went down on like three fairway. He didn't make it. He didn't even make it past like the entrance to the, you know, you do that first little loop. And picked him up in the ambulance, like right next to three green. Oh yeah, he was done. It was so hot. Like, I mean, Mississippi's hot, but I mean, it's a little windier here than it is in Annandale and in the central part of the state. So we'll see. But yeah, it's gonna be good. It'll be fun.
Appreciate it, bud.
Anytime.
Thanks to Jonathan, as always, a super guy, always helpful with us. You'll hear from him plenty more on this show as we keep going in the weeks and months ahead. He will be at the Byron Nelson next week. The players this week at TPC Sawgrass. I was listening to a press conference with Rory McIlroy before we started recording this morning, Jeffrey, and it seems like, as they do, because we're members of it, we understand it, the press asking all players the same questions. They're trying to get that toughest field in golf soundbite, and they're also really playing up the fact that no one has advantages because you don't really hit many drivers. I think Rory said he would hit five or six drivers at most over the course of a round. And with that being the case, everyone's playing from the same spots, and this comes down to iron play and short games with maybe one of the – it's a cookie-cutter course, but a course that does take the driver out of play for a lot of guys.
No, and, you know, and there's trouble to be had. So it's definitely a good example of – man, you got to control the golf ball. And, you know, to discuss what we were kind of discussing at the top of the show, like, that's why you kind of see, like, the wide range of winners that we have, you know? You can have Fred Funk win. You can have KJ Choi win. And then you can have Tiger win twice. You can have Jason Day win. So it really puts a premium. Honestly, it really puts a premium on just kind of hitting greens. Because by their standards, these greens aren't huge. It's not a big ballpark whatsoever. But if you put the ball on the green, you're going to give yourself a couple of chances. So, I don't know. Like, it is a weird... Does it not feel... And I've wondered this, Chase. Is it we've become, like, guys like you and me, guys that are, like, true golf fans, have we just become so, like, annoyed with the whole... Is this a fifth major manufactured debate? Like, I just find myself, like, not all that excited about this event. And then I wondered, is it the whole fifth major thing? Or is it just, hey, man, it's kind of sandwiched now, like, because of the date. It's in May. Because I think next year when it moves to March again, I do think I'll find myself a little more geeked up because it's before the Masters now, so you can kind of get the... All right, this will be like a nice kickoff to golf, where there's like, and then the Masters is like, you know, what you're looking forward to. Then you've got another major in May, another major in June, another major in July. Like, the golf calendar is going to make more sense. But, like, I find myself kind of just, I'm kind of checked out right now on the players.
No, that's absolutely true. And it's the way it's shoved down your throat. And I don't know why, though, we feel like it's in the middle of nowhere, because frankly, it should be a great setup right here. The Masters hangover is kind of over. We're ready for a great field event. I mean, it's like last week. The Wells Fargo should have been this big-time deal just because the field that was invited. And then you get – I get Jason Day one, but you get this boring final day.
Yep.
Frankly, you get 9 or 10 holes with nothing happening. It was just a bunch of pars and a bunch of nothing. There was no fireworks. There was no run from anybody coming up from – behind in the leaderboard. This should be perfect, but I think it's such a desire for the players and the PGA of America to give it this, or sorry, the PGA Tour to give it this major feel and to shove it down your throats to where it is have a turned off effect. It's a directly opposite effect of what they're hoping for. And then I think there's also something to the string of kind of winners that don't necessarily make sense from a top golf standpoint. Yes, the toughest field, but when you've got Siwoo Kim as the defending champion, nothing against him. He's very underrated, especially considering his age. But a lot of times you get winners that don't necessarily move the dial. I mean, you got the big Ricky Fowler thing a couple years ago where he goes on the run, birdies 7 in a row or whatever it was to finish and win. But for the most part, there's not the string of winners that excites anything but the hardcore fan.
No, I mean, you got, you know, yes, Jason Day won. Yes, Ricky Fowler won. Kimer's won. Tigers won. But man,
Bill's won.
Then you got Stephen Ames. Then you got Fred Funk, and no offense to either one of them, Tim Clark, like KJ Choi, like Craig Perks, like you have this group of winners that, and I understand, like, that's kind of, I guess if you're trying to make a tournament just for the touring pro, like that, like, I guess
it's their shtick. Yeah, it's
like,
the purpose.
I get it. But to me, this becomes like a whole, like, I started thinking about it today. It's like, I think this is kind of what has, like, we go back to like design and golf course architecture. You mentioned last week with Quail Hollow. Okay, Quail Hollow was another Fazio redo. And I just feel like on so many of those golf courses, the idea is to protect par when they do these massive redesigns. And so because the idea is to protect par, you wind up getting these just boring Sundays because no one's doing anything. It like becomes like a survivalist. And I'm cool with that on the U.S. Open. Like, to me, like, that's what that tournament should be. Like, I get that. Like, that should be the exception. That shouldn't just be like the tournament stop in Charlotte. Like, I don't know. Like, give me some fireworks. Give me something down the stretch that's exciting. Like, it is funny that, like, Augusta went all in on using basically Fazio when they did their big redesign with the idea of protecting par. And the reason why we love Augusta is the back nine, there's the chance for fireworks. Like, you can be standing on 10T, three or four back, and you still got a chance because there's so much risk, so much reward. But when you get all these Fazio designs and these big ballparks that all they're just trying to do is protect par, it just makes this kind of finish.
When you hit it, it's the matter of risk reward. We're not asking for no rough, nothing but fireworks right. In a positive way. It's let me get some big numbers too. Maybe they get a three, but hey, maybe they get a nine.
Right.
That's
like
cool.
That's what I love. It's like the idea that if you hit, you know, if you take an aggressive line that has, you know, trouble, if you mishit it, you're going to be in trouble. Like, I'm cool with that. But also, if you pull off the shot, like, you shouldn't have to hit an amazing shot just to sit there and make par. Like, if you hit an amazing drive and you put yourself in position with a wedge, dude, I think that's, like, that's golf. Like, that's talent. Like, your skill allowed you that opportunity. And, like, I'm totally cool with that. It's this idea of just try to make it as, like, this whole idea that we don't want people shooting, you know, 62 every single day, because what does that say about our golf course? Like, that's what drives me insane. It's like, I'm totally cool with risk reward. And if you pull it off, you should be rewarded. Cause like, I feel like that was the design of the game.
If it's about iron play, if it's about,
it's a ball striker course.
Around the
like
greens.
You look at almost everyone that's won, honestly, with the exception of Day when he won in 16, when he just was getting up and down from everywhere. Like, he would just get himself in jail and then get up and down. But like, for the most part, it's like some classic ball strikers. Like, Siwoo Kim's a ball striker. Ricky Fowler's a ball striker. Keimer. God, that guy.
That's kind of where I'm going here. Why has Jordan Spieth not had more success than him? He finishes T4 and 14, but that's with a 74 on Sunday, and he's missed the cut in 15, 16, and 17.
Well, it is the weird thing about Jordan Spieth. While we don't think of like Spieth as one of the biggest hitters, Spieth is very much in line with all of those guys on, he's super aggressive off the tee. He almost always takes driver and he tries to just hit as far as he can. He doesn't care where it winds up.
So at this place, he's going to be stupid. And when instead he's a great ball striker right. And iron player, if he just do that.
Right. So like, I've never understood, like, Jordan Spieth with his 3-wood is about as lethal of a positional player as there is out there. I've never understood why he just doesn't just carry 3-wood around there. Like, put the driver in the freaking bag, like, leave it at home and just hit 3-wood all over that place. And then you're the best iron player alive right now. Like, it makes no sense to me, but you know, he plays the same way that we've been talking about these guys that are the modern golfer. That's everything is super aggressive off the tee. Get as far down there as you can. And then figure it out from there. And so I think that's why he struggled so much here.
So who are our picks? Give me one of the top guns. Give me somebody else. Then maybe somebody that's going to surprise.
Okay, so big guns. I don't know why, man. I like his demeanor right now. I think of the big guns, I'm going Rory.
You are going Rory?
I do think he's kind of figured this place out. Like, Rory is a little bit of a slow learner, but when he does figure it out, like, it usually gets pretty good. I mean, he does have the course record there. So, like, I think he's, and now I feel like he's in a better position than he has been in years past, really working the ball both directions. Like, I do think he's very comfortable hitting a cut now, where I don't think he was in some other years. And then, you know, last year he had the injury, obviously, and he's even admitted, like, dude, I couldn't hit the ball right. Like, I just couldn't. Like, everything had to be a hook or a draw. And so I like him a lot here. You know, then if you're going best of the rest, I really like where Rahm is right now, man. I think he's kind of peaking at the right time.
Number three in the world is best for the rest.
Well, I mean, on like most of like the draft boards, like he's going to be like, that is the weird thing. It's like, he's number three in the world, but like, he's not put in that caliber because he hasn't won as much.
Yeah. He's only really expensive in my fantasy, where we go by world golf ranking points.
Right. So
he's expensive for me. Rory's actually eighth in that as far as most expensive players.
So there you go. You can flip flop him. Another money making machine that this course, I got to imagine he licks his chops at every time he gets here. Paul Casey, I feel like, is always a great person here. Little off the radar Euro if you're looking for something. Francesco Molinari's played some really good golf, dude. I think he makes sense there.
I think Tyrrell Hatton makes sense here if he knows the course at all.
Totally agree. And then a guy that you and I like a lot, and I guess he's now kind of, I think he's becoming a little bit more in the public consciousness, but I think Patrick Cantlay makes a ton of sense here.
I've been a fan every single week. I've kind of considered picking him. That's a possibility. Kind of last thing, do you believe in the lack of left-hander success? Does that keep you away from a Phil or a Brian Harman this week?
Yeah, I mean,
Phil's won it, but he's got a first and a third. But after Phil, I think Brian Harman's like somewhere around top 10 is the best left-handed finish in the last so many years.
Almost every single person that like I respect their kind of opinion when it comes to like prognosticating, they put a ton of stock into this thing doesn't set up for left-handers, because most of the left-handers, when they have a ton of success, it's because largely they can just hit massive cuts when the right-handers have to hit massive draws. And so it allows them to kind of swing a little more freely, a little more easily. But like, if we look at like most of the left-handers, they're a little erratic off the tee, and that's just not, that's not how you win here, man.
Give you one more sleeper here. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, because all the damage is on the left too. So when they start hitting those big cuts,
yes,
a lot of the trouble's on that side. So they're scared of what should be their safe play.
Right.
I kind of like Cam Smith as an underdog this week.
I do too. I love his game, dude.
Makes a lot of sense to me. What about Justin Rose?
I mean, he is the ball striker's ball striker.
Yeah, I'm just saying. He's not that expensive on some different boards. So just a thought there.
Is it him or is Adam Scott? Who is someone that you would rather watch on the driving range? Like someone who's as boring as it gets on a golf course, yet they're just like one of the purest ball strikers out there. It's either of those two, right?
It was Adam Scott for years, but here in the last year or so when he's lost his game, I want to say, and I think I used this quote, this stat maybe on the first podcast we did, I don't think he's had a top 10 or something since St. Jude last year.
I think that was what you said. And the other thing is like, we're talking about like Justin Rose is kind of like, you know, maybe kind of that second tier sleeper. He has a chance to become world number one if he wins. Like, he needs a lot of help. But if he wins this week, he could be the number one player in the world. Like, when I somehow got on the weird world golf ranking rabbit hole yesterday, I think he won like five times worldwide last year.
He got incredibly hot in the fall, where he had seven straight top five finishes or something in the fall.
That's a man after our own heart. Nothing like silly season golf. Love those guys.
As soon as the FedEx Cup was over and the race to Dubai is going, he just went lava hot is what he did. No, I think there's five different players that can be number one in the world after this week, depending on what happens. Dustin actually has a decent amount of work to do to keep it.
Well, and then also like this has never been a spot for him, man. Like, he's almost every list I've seen, he's like a stay away guy. Like, you look at his first time there, he missed the cut. Then he has a T79, T34, T57. He was out in 12. 13, he withdrew. 14, T59. 15 was the T69. Nice. Sure, he probably definitely kept that one. 16, T28. Last year's a T12, his best finish. Was 2012, was that his suspension year? Was it that long ago?
It had to have been, as we were talking about that, because he was the Whistling Straits year was 14, right?
I think that's right. No.
So, yeah.
15. 15.
Okay.
15, because that's when I played it.
Gotcha. Last thing, visor guy or no for Justin Thomas yesterday?
I thought it looked weird, didn't you?
Well, is it just weird because we haven't seen it, or is it just weird because it's weird?
I think JT's got the same problem that I do. And I was, because of course it sent me down a nice thought rabbit hole yesterday. My hot theory on visors is, if you do not, I think you have to have at least a head of, like a fitted hat size of 7 1/4 at the minimum to be able to wear a visor. I think guys that have little heads, it doesn't sit right on us, man. I'm telling you, it's weird.
Because you're a cartoon character, or just the way it actually sits?
Remember, I showed you, like, because you thought I was making it up, and then yeah. I got a visor out and I said, "Look," and it looked fine on you, and it looked weird on me, and we both were in agreement. It wasn't just me like going like I think it looks stupid on me, like, because the truth is, like, it's starting to heat up now. I'd like to kind of be a visor guy. They're cooler, literally, like, temperature-wise, they're cooler. And, you know, it'd be nice to not have to wear all of my just sweat-soaked hats all the time. But it just doesn't work for me, dude.
And you've got the hair. It's just something about the head size.
It's weird. I think you have to have, like, a 7 1/4. Because didn't you see, like, it sat weird... It sat up, like, and then, like, he tried, you could tell it was bothering him, because he tried to pull it down at one point.
Yeah, he did that thing like he was taking a flat bill and trying to pull it down in his eyebrows.
Yeah, and it just doesn't work. I'm telling you, I think he's got the same problem I do.
Let us know on Twitter if we're crazy here. Can you pull off the visor? Can you not pull off the visor? Curious with the conversation. As always, thanks to Jonathan Randolph. Talk to you next week.